We're live now on Radio Edutalk. This is Wednesday, the 28th, I'm guessing, of August at about 8 p.m. This is a special from the e-assessment conference. Now, the e-assessment conference was on Dundee last Friday, and we're David Noble, who's over in Dalgety Bay, and myself in Glasgow, are really honoured to be joined by Kenji Lamb, one of the main organisers of the conference, and the keynote speaker from the conference, Catherine Cronin. So, we're going to hear a wee bit of hope from Catherine about what she talked about. She had a fantastic keynote. I had a conversation with Catherine at the assessment conference about some of the things she talked about. We didn't get time to get into any all of them, so we'll maybe dig into that a wee bit. And Kenji and Catherine hopefully maybe reflect on how the conference has gone. Now it's nearly over, there's still some things you can catch. Catherine, can you maybe just quickly give us a life story, etc.? I know you did it the last time, but just for the listeners tonight, where you came from, and bits and pieces like that.
Sure. Delighted to be here, first of all. I am currently living on the west coast of Ireland in Galway. I work at the university, the National University of Ireland here in Galway. But I'm originally from New York City, from the Bronx. And I've lived in a few different places in the States and also in Scotland. I lived for 6 years in Dunblane in Scotland, worked for Stirling University and the Open University during the time that I was there. But all of my work, I started out as an engineer, all of my work in recent years has been really around education. I've worked in community education and for quite a long time now in higher education, although I liaise quite a bit with schools, both primary schools and secondary schools. That's part of what I think we need to do as open educators, which is what I spoke about last week.
Yep. Thank you very much, Catherine. And Kenji, yourself, your sort of backstory.
Yeah, hi. Well, I started out as an English teacher, and I was always interested in education and also technology, so I was always fiddling around in the background. So when I started out as a teacher, when I say English teacher, I should say that it's ESOL, so teaching English to people who don't speak English as their first language. And I taught out in Canada for a short time, and then I sort of spanned the globe and ended up in Japan for probably the longest period, running a distance learning unit where it was really just about using the technology to make our lessons more interactive. And then eventually ended up back here in the UK, working for a group called JISC, which supports further and higher education, and then eventually for myself, with a bunch of ex-JISC colleagues. We run a company working in the educational field, and we continue to work with conferences like e-assessment Scotland. And I have to say, when I work for e-assessment Scotland and other things like that, I always end up running around in the background, and I kind of miss all the stuff that I've organized. So one of the reasons for coming along tonight is I just kind of want to hear what the talk was,
yeah,
that Catherine gave, because I've heard so much about it. I did pop in for the first minute or two when we were having kind of technical issues.
Yeah.
But I missed the actual stuff, the delivery. So, you know, what I'm waiting for is for Catherine to tell me everything in basically, you know, 3 minutes, summarize everything and tell me all the good bits. And it was all good, so, you know, yeah, that's to be a task.
I think it was. It's a wonderful keynote, and it was basically about open, I guess, Catherine. And maybe you could just go across some of your key points and ideas around this. Or
yeah, it was about openness, and I called it assessment in open spaces. And I suppose I really talked a lot about learning in open spaces, and then brought that to looking at some examples of how people are doing assessment and feedback in open spaces. But I started with one of my favorite quotes by Joy Ito, which is, he said that, "I don't think education is about centralized instruction anymore. It's the process of establishing oneself as a node in a broad network of distributed creativity." And as certainly as an open networked learner myself, that's very much where I see learning going. But it's a challenge for us to embrace that in formal education institutions. Although, you know, I think it's an imperative that we do that. So what I looked at was ourselves as educators. Obviously, we're learners first before we're educators. And many of us understand what it is to be a networked educator. So, you know, the sources of information that we have for learning are so different than they were a few years ago. We're connected in so many different ways, physically to people that we work with and colleagues and our other networks, but also, of course, online, through social media, through open online spaces and other systems. So we know what it's like to be a networked learner. Our students also know that. They're very, very well connected, many of them. And we meet. Where do we meet? Where do connected networked educators meet connected networked students? So I looked at a map of that and identified three different types of spaces that we meet. The first is a traditional classroom or a building, a physical space that we meet. The second is in bounded online spaces, so things like learning management systems and things where we have to sign in to get there, to all be someplace together. And the third type of space is open online spaces. So I suppose what I did then in the rest of the keynote was just look at the different affordances of those kinds of spaces. And my main point is that in the first two, in classrooms and in bounded online spaces, we cannot connect with our networks when we're together there as educators and students. So we can't bring in what we learn and share with our networks, and we can't share out what we're doing. But if we meet in open online spaces, even part of the time, it's not saying that we all need to just leave our classrooms and go learn and teach in MOOCs, but if we even embrace it a little bit, it changes the dynamic of education significantly and makes it so much richer.
Can it just take you back to the joy quote? Can you maybe just run it by us again and unpick it a wee bit? And I thought that was a great quote.
Yes. Well, it's from, I had the reference in my quote, it's from a New York Times article. I think it was an interview that he did, and the story was in the New York Times in December 2011. And what I said at the conference was that I took the quote and I superimposed it on a Creative Commons image that's of a tree with lots of buds, which I think is a lovely image of a network. And I've used the slide probably in all of my talks since that. But the quote is, Joy says, "I don't think education is about centralized instruction anymore. It is about the process of establishing oneself as a node in a broad network of distributed creativity." So, I mean, do you feel yourselves as learners, do you relate to that quote, let's say, as a learner?
Personally, I think, yes, I do, in my unsalaried time, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my salaried time, and I think there's a different reality. What I had written down when you said that at the conference was the old William Gibson chestnut is the future evenly distributed, you know, because that picture is wonderful, but it's not happening in as many places as maybe it could. There's a lot of fear and uncertainty and stuff around the whole space.
And what about you, Kenji?
I kind of if you're talking about the typical kind of itchy idea of a lecture where obviously you've got your sage on the stage or otherwise delivering out, and you're kind of you're bringing in this idea of a more sort of openness. We're bringing in different sources of information and acknowledging, I suppose, honestly for once, that we're learning from each other and learning from all sorts of sources, whether that be Google in 1 minute or YouTube the next, or the person talking in front of you. I think that's an excellent idea, and I love, I get excited by the kind of people who are willing to sort of just experiment with the different modes of learning and acknowledge that we're learning from each other all of the time.
Yes, I
kind of like to see that in action. I see it described a lot. Mm-hmm. I hear people talking about it, but what you really want to know is how do I do that?
Yes.
And more important, what does it mean for assessment and the actual process of assessment? And those are the kind of keys that I'm interested in, obviously from the perspective of the eAssessment Scotland conference.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly think that the Joy quote is what's happening in learning. But I agree with you, John, that it's very patchy about in terms of what's happening in schools and colleges and universities. I think there's a great potential for this to happen in education, although it's already happening in informal learning. And this is what we do: we connect with people. We use Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and all the rest to learn things that we want to learn. How do I get from A to B? How do I learn to play the song on the guitar or whatever it might be? The one point about these open online spaces, though, is that I think is very significant is that in classrooms and bounded online spaces, the identity of the educator is very distinct from the identity of the student. So in the classroom, we're working against the weight of history and the architecture of many of the rooms that we teach in. You know, we have to try very hard to undo what's in people's heads about what happens in a classroom. And there are some wonderful teachers at all levels that try and do that, but you were really working against the tide there. And even in bounded online spaces like learning management systems, you know, we're identified. It says it on there. You have the privileges of a student, and if you're the lecturer or the teacher, you have the privileges of the instructor, and you can do different things in those spaces. So in open spaces, if we can meet in open spaces online, we have the potential to all be learners, to be social peers. Now, again, that isn't always what happens, but the potential is there. And if we're aware of that, we can, again, I think that's very powerful and allow people to establish their own identities, invite other identities into the conversations, and break across the boundaries of, you know, our schools, our institutions, geography, culture, you know, all of those things. And I see teachers doing that at primary and secondary level. I gave some examples, and I do it myself at third level. So I agree, Kenji, it's you know, that's how we all learn. That's how I learned, by looking at people who did this. And I think it's important that we share examples.
Can I just say, though, like, talking about assessment, though, mm-hmm. is when people are coming, traditionally, people are coming forth and they want to learn something, but they generally look towards someone to teach them. I mean, that's the kind of traditional model, I guess. And mm-hmm. when you talk about assessment, so I'm learning from you. You're sharing your information and your experience and your knowledge with me, and mm-hmm. and you're providing usually a structure for me to learn under. And students feel safe in that kind of recognized idea that I'm here to learn, and you're here to teach. And when you try to sort of mess with that dynamic, when you try to get people to say, well, look, you should be more involved in your own assessment. And I got an element of that when I was joining the Jim Groom session, mm-hmm. where I was there with John, where mm-hmm. he's saying, well, no, you know, people should be free to sort of experiment and maybe lay down their own rules and define how they should be assessed and maybe change mm-hmm. some of those assessment scenarios. But
yes.
I generally find that students get really uncomfortable and nervous in those situations, and it's not always easy to kind of get them to participate. So can you give me kind of some concrete examples of how that works for assessment?
Yeah, I mean, learning and discomfort, I mean, that often happen together. You know, it's when we're uncomfortable that we experience this, you know, this difference between, you know, what I think I know and what I think looks like happening over there. You know, what is that? And let me leap across that space. I mean, I think discomfort and learning go hand in hand. I mean, it isn't a matter of a smooth journey always. So an example from my own situation is I I'm a lecturer, and I said last Friday that I'm loath to call myself a lecturer, and I always qualify it when I say it. That's my job description, but it's not what I do. And I think our job descriptions haven't caught up with our practice yet, unfortunately. However, I do teach a second year module on our BSc in Computer Science and IT program at NUI Galway. And that module is called Professional Skills. It's been called that for years. And it used to be just research and communication skills. And now it also encompasses, you know, social media and making media. So we use Twitter, and we use students' blog, and you know, we use a lot of different media in the course. But the students are asked to, I ask them what they want to create for their final project, for example. So we have a few small activities at the in the beginning where we explore digital identity, for example, because we use Twitter in the course, and I don't think it's fair to walk in on day one and say to students, now we're going to use Twitter, just connect with me on your Twitter account. We have a discussion about digital identity, who they are online, who would they like to be online, what does digital identity mean over time, and then they get to consider whether they might like to use their existing Twitter account or create a new Twitter account for this space. So all that's really important. But eventually we get to the final digital media project, and I ask the students what they would like to create. And the task is simply to create something in the form of digital media that is for someone outside the university to benefit from. And it could be anything that they're interested in or passionate about. So students pick things like teaching someone to play the guitar, how to build a computer, teaching kids how to be safe on Facebook, teaching older people who've never used computers how they might start using tablet computers, all kinds of things like that. They can choose the tools they use, the media they use, the form of the project, and we create the rubric together about how those will be measured, and they give each other peer feedback. And those projects are the richest work that I've seen in all the years that I've been teaching. And it's because it's the student voice and their choice about how they want to learn and in what form. And, you know, the more I step back, the more, as I said, the richer what the students create is. And where social media comes in is at the point in the term when they take on that final project, they know that they're not going to be giving this just to me. You know, so they're not speaking in an inauthentic voice, as I've seen students do before. What does she want to hear and how does she want to hear it? They know that the world is listening. The world knows where we are. We use hashtags, we use Twitter. There are these spaces, and they know how to share, and there's a potential for anybody to see what they create. And that is the difference.
Well, I'm interested because that describes a process of learning, which obviously is very much tied into the idea of assessment. But mm-hmm. in a typical model, ultimately, students are going towards, well, you know, a lot of them are really just interested in the piece of paper, the certificate, the grade mm-hmm. that they get at the end of the day. And in mm-hmm. that kind of teaching process, ultimately, if you're saying they're choosing a project or choosing the tools that they need to learn, they're still building towards that ultimate assessment artifact at the end of the day that they're going to get assessed upon. Mm-hmm. And how I was really interested by a guy, Derek Jones, who won an award at yes. a conference, and he was showing me a piece of software that he used. It's called Compendium, an open yes. source piece of software, and he was really interested in the idea. He said, when we assess on this OU course that he delivers, which is about design and creativity, he said an interesting point was, we don't assess the final product that's being developed at the end of the day or the design. He said, what we're looking at is the process. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in the ideas that he had about using technology to assess processes. He mm-hmm. said, we look at the way that the students are evolving their design, the way the approaches that they use, and we use this software to sort of map out what it is they're doing at every stage. And it's at the end of the day, we don't really care what it is they've made or yes. they've produced, whether they've worked, whether it works or whether it fails or it matches the criteria that they've set mm-hmm. out. He said, what we're looking at is that how they learn, how they just the kind of routes they make, the self-assessment they make at different stages. And I'm interested in the rubrics that you actually map that against to actually get a grade at the end of the day. But it's really interesting that they're talking more about process about product and artifact at the end of the day. So I'm interested in your courses. How do you manage the assessment, and does it focus upon that final point, or is it about the process?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had a chat with Derek at the conference, and I'm really intrigued by what he's doing. And this is exactly the point, is that what happens is when we get together to talk about these things, we're all learning from each other all the time, which is so exciting. So you kind of go and you have a few of your own ideas to share, and then you come away with loads more. I was also excited by a lot of that. The rubrics that we came up with, I mean, the word rubric is a bit odd as well, but the students and I discuss, you know, what's important about this, you know, what we're doing and what you're creating, and how should it be measured? You know, we're here at a university, you're doing a module, you'll get a mark for the module. None of us like this whole notion of grading. What we're doing here is so much richer than a grade. But what's a good way to measure what's going on here? Now, one of the other pieces of assessment that leads up to this digital media project is also a presentation that the students do in class. So I was working with Helen Keegan students and students at other universities and colleges. There are five of us, so that the students uploaded their presentations online, and then my students uploaded their presentations online. Helen's students and Avril Gordon's students in New Zealand looked at our students' presentations, which we shared on Scoop It. Some of them had videos, some of them were just slides. And unmediated by us, unmediated by their teachers, their lecturers, the students could kind of trawl through there and find things that they were interested in, and then riff off that to create what they wanted to do for their module. Again, I think it's a matter of just trying to peel back, you know, a lot of what we traditionally do and we don't reflect upon, like you're saying, Kenji. You know, what do the students want to do? What do they want to create? And what's a fair way to allow them to share that? That's the most important thing, the learning and the sharing. And then the assessment is another joint decision that we make, you know, on top of that.
So at the conference at the end of the day, I had a wee conversation with Phil Race, who was talking about multi-choice questions, which I would have thought were... I didn't hear the workshop he led because I was talking to folk and recording and things, but he talked about multi-choice. Immediately I thought, right, multi-choice. It sounds a horrible idea, you know, you have one in four chance of getting it right. And first he said, well, we have big long lists, you don't have just four questions, you have lots. But you involve the students in creating the multi-choice questions, deciding what's a good question, deciding what's a good distractor from the right answer. So something that looks like the right answer but isn't, but will fool somebody that doesn't really know what they're talking about. And that just seemed a really interesting take in involving students in what would have previously I would have thought of as a very mechanical form of assessment, this idea of involving students. And I think you touched on that, and I think Jim Groom touched on it the other day about the fact that the tasks are set by students and that students can feel at the task. But if they narrate the process and show understanding of what they're actually trying to learn, that's more important than making a good artifact.
Yes. And it's really... I mean, I had the same reaction about the multiple choice questions, but it's the process is very similar to what Jim Groom was saying and what I've experienced. And it's looking through the opposite end of the telescope, if you like. It's not trying to say, here's what I want you all to do, and that's all decided before you walk in the room. But it's asking, you know, what would you like to do? And another example is, a question came up after my presentation about, you know, how do we avoid students plagiarizing, you know, answers. And I said, well, you know, plagiarizing is only something that we talk about in the university. And of course, outside, we call it collaboration. So, you know, one of the things that we're looking at in is, you know, assuming that students will look online, because that's what we do when we want to find out how to do something. We look and see, how have other people done it? And can I do it better? Can I use a bit of this and a bit of that? So instead of trying really hard to find something that cannot be found online, which is what I see a lot of people desperately trying to do, maybe rephrase the question to be, let's find out a whole bunch of ways to do this, and then let's look at them together and figure out, you know, what are good ones, what are not so good, what could we do to improve them. And again, I think it's just a matter of looking at through the other end of the lens. And once you start thinking like that, then there are just so many things we can do. But making that shift in thinking is probably the hardest thing.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt because I like the sound of my own voice principally. But there's a few things. One of the things is talking about assessment and you mentioned, Catherine, like the grade. You know, what? Why are we fixating upon the grade? And I hear that a lot. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of students, ultimately, the grade is what matters. Because when they walk out of the course they're doing at school or college or university, they have to show that piece of paper to employers, and that's what they get judged upon. And so the grade is important. So, you know, it's hard to get away from that. I like the idea about students creating their own questions. And we do have a presentation on Friday at 9:30 UK time. It's another plug, sorry. But it's Paul Denny and this Peerwise program that he's created. And it's basically having students create their own questions and that process and how important that is and how that can, using his platform, capture the idea of students making their own questions. It's really interesting, really been done well. University of Edinburgh previously, I'm going to forget a name here. Somebody will have to remind me. Simon, Stephen, somebody, where the unit in the physics department, where the students designed their own questions, and they were actually used as part of the final summative tests. I mean, that's a fascinating process and really worth looking at. But I'm also interested by the kind of constraints of the way that we have to work. Hugh Daly, a guy I used to work with in the regional sports centre in Edinburgh, he was telling me technology has this idea of presenting assessment when you're ready to do it. It was a fantastic idea because e-assessment should allow you, really, when you're ready, you're not constrained by having to do a six-month course, but when you're ready, you should be able to take the assessment, not be dictated to by the kind of assessment calendar that you face at university. If you're ready, the ideal should be that you just go, well, put your hand up and say, that's it, give me the test, and I'll show you that I know everything now. And that's brilliant. Mm-hmm. But then he said, you know, that's a good idea, but you're constrained by things like funding bodies, which grade you for the amount of attendance time that you have within a class. You have to know that, you know, unless you attend a class for 80% of the time, you're not going to pass. So how do you get beyond that? Even though we have all the technology, we can capture process, we've got all these different ways of measuring things, but we can't break out of this kind of the straitjacket of the systems that we have to sit through. Sorry, I'm rabbiting now.
Yes. Yeah, that really interesting questions. I'm not sure what you want me to focus on there. I think you just made a few great points, basically.
So can we just take a slight break, because I can mind, not remind, because I didn't mind people earlier on. If you're listening live and you want to ask a question of Kenji or Catherine, you can just send a tweet out to anything you like with the edutalk, edutalk hashtag, or you could tweet at edutalker, it's edutalkr, or if you're an email person, you could email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. that hopefully has given us a wee break to maybe think if there is an answer to Kenji's question, Catherine, or we can take it
well,
in another direction.
Well, I suppose what I'm really excited by is the idea that we work with our students as peers, as learners, and it's this whole notion of our identities. I think we can fall easily into the identity of the lecturer or the educator or the teacher that has control over the situation, and that's what traditionally happens. So I think open online spaces and working with students as peers and asking them, what would you like to create and how would you like to do it, and you know, how would you like to be measured? And, you know, as I know Dave Cormier says, give yourself a grade. These are ways of working that I think, you know, a few brave people are doing inside institutions. And I think, you know, I'm learning an awful lot from people who are doing it, and I'm pushing the boundaries in my own institution. But this is a space that we have to go. And I say to my students, for example, that I mentioned this on Friday, that, you know, albeit that they need the grades and the piece of paper and all that you said, Kenji, but it's not really enough for us, you know, to have students leave our institutions with, you know, their degree and their grades and, you know, some good memories and, you know, a lot of things they've learned and some great friends, but they should also leave with a live, rich personal learning network. So from the day they leave, they can continue learning in the ways that they've been practicing and that we've been doing alongside them, you know, while they've been inside the institutions. You know, we don't do any favors by treating students as, you know, as separate to us, you know, as learners other than us, if, you know, I believe. So, you know, I think this whole idea of partnering and being peers as learners together, albeit with different responsibilities, is really important and is the starting point.
I don't think many people who are connected would disagree with much on that, Catherine. I think David's got a couple of questions that have come in from Twitter.
Yeah, I'll come in with them in a moment. John, I was just listening to Catherine there. Catherine, last week when we were discussing some aspects of e-assessment and the show just before the Friday conference, we were talking about the impact of the REF, for example, on the lack of innovation in higher education, and mm-hmm. I just wonder if you'd like to comment. You know, if you have members of staff in a university, for example, who are working within possibly a climate of increasing managerialism and performativity, mm-hmm. do you think that's possibly one of the key factors as to why we're not seeing some of these open assessment or open educational practices?
Yes, in a word, yes. I think this came up in the conversation with Christina last week. I wasn't able to listen to the broadcast live, but I listened to the recording, and Christina noted that we're identifying kind of two tracks of academics at the moment, and that there are some of us who, you know, as you've just said, John, embrace open practices, and you know, and there are many who recognize that that's not what is rewarded in the formal system, and are going with more of the traditional norms of, you know, publishing in high impact journals and so on. And I think this is something that Bonnie Stewart has been studying and is planning to study in some depth. And she's been blogging about that recently. And you know, it's basically two different cultures. Martin Weller talks about it as well in his book, The Digital Scholar. So, I mean, we recognize this, and there's a level of frustration if one is the former, kind of, you know, an open educator in blogging and other activities like that that may not be recognized. There's a frustration there, but it's that is the situation at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'll come in with a couple of online comments at the moment, then, if that's okay. And
yes.
I'll maybe ask a couple of questions as well that have come in, and you can choose to answer all of the questions or just pick one out. I think we'll maybe start off, John, if you're okay with your dear friend, as I keep calling him, Ian Guest, Ian at Ian in Sheffield, and Ian, of course, was a delegate at the assessment conference.
Hello, Ian.
And Ian's just wondering, Catherine, whether open and connected, notions of openness and connectedness or various other associated terms, whether they run parallel or if they're interchangeable terms. And another question from Ian is he wonders whether people's job descriptions and job titles, as you maybe alluded to earlier, Catherine, are hindering them from becoming more open, networked, or creative.
Yes, the second one first. It's an interest of mine. I've been talking about it with people for the last number of months. Many of the people that I am connected with and work with, share ideas with online, I've been asking people, you know, how much of what you do is in your job description? How much of what I see you do online is in your job description? And how much of what you do that you love and are passionate about is in your job description? And very, very, very many of them say not at all. You know, that the things that we're doing that we learned the most from and that motivated us the most are not what is in our formal job descriptions, which is curious. In the terms of the first question, open and networked, well, open is kind of a prerequisite for being networked, I would say. So, you know, openness is about, for me, firstly, obviously about using, creating and sharing things openly, but again, I used a Jim Groom quote in my talk that it's really an ethos, not just a practice. And by doing those things, you know, we can network with others who are also doing those things. So I would say I'm an open networked educator. Yes.
I liked one of the presentations. I don't really get a chance to see many of the presentations, mm-hmm. so it's always a frustration. But one of the presenters, John Hilton, I'm hoping I get the name right, mm-hmm. and he came up from St. George's, and he was interested in one of the tasks he was set in his course, where he's given a kind of a scenario, and he's given a multiple set of choices where you're in a situation, for example, in a clinical room, and you're said, you're faced with this task. Somebody's come in and they're, I don't know, they've got a bang on their head, and you're given four choices. What should you do? Should you, I don't know, call a nurse, examine the wound further, bandage his head, or send him packing, or maybe check his insurance card? And he said, He didn't like the multiple choice kind of option where you were presented with a series of choices. What he wanted to do is, but you've got an infinite number of choices. You should have a system that doesn't give you choices, but asks you, what do you do? And he came up with this idea of interactive fiction, where he said, You're given an open text option. Tell me what you want to do. Don't give me a choice of A, B, C, or D, but just let me decide what I want to do openly. And he'd written it in a sort of game platform using this Inform 7 technique, where it harped back to an older gaming system. And it was really interesting how he, as a student, saw a kind of issue with the way that his university was presenting him with tasks, and he'd come up with his own idea of how that should be done, and it was really fascinating. And it's interesting how you encourage students. How do you make them become more part of that process? How do you encourage them to take on that kind of critical role and present you with ideas and approaches? And I just found that really exciting.
That is interesting. I often use one of my favorite quotes by Margaret Mead with students when we talk about what they're going to do, what they're going to create, And that quote, of course, is, you know, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And I purposely change the word citizens to students, because I think sometimes students, you know, we call them students, feel very disempowered in terms of changing the world. You know, they're just students. So again, it's looking through that lens differently, just saying, I work with second years students, and saying, you know, you bring a lot of passion into this course. You chose to study information technology for a number of reasons. You've learned quite a bit, you know, here already, in addition to what you've learned informally. What else would you like to learn? What else would you like to do? Some really want to get into audio. Some want to get into music. Some want to get into filmmaking. So that can be their form of what they create. You know, I don't mind. So that may be they're learning something that they want to learn. But as long as it's communicating something that is of value to someone outside the university, that meets the requirements, you know, that are established. It's as simple as that. So so I find if we can tap into students' own passions and interests, the motivation is there. You know, we're not pushing the end of a rope. The passion is there, the motivation is there.
That kind of links in quite well, I think, Catherine, with another question from Ian on Twitter. And his question is, do students have an informal, non-formal learning world which is disconnected from their formal learning places?
Yes, that's a great question, Ian. I quoted David Wiley, who's written about that, and he calls it, Ian probably knows this already, he calls this, David Wiley calls it the daily divide. And he's building on the notion of the digital divide, which is, you know, students who are connected and not connected outside school. The daily divide is when we ask students to walk in to schools and classrooms, and, you know, we say, put down your phones and, you know, leave all that, you know, outside. So this is the daily divide that what we're in effect teaching them is that informal learning and formal learning are separate and they're disconnected. And obviously that's not good. So, you know, one of the ideas that I've been looking at recently is Chris Gutierrez's notion of third spaces of learning, which are not formal spaces of learning nor informal, but kind of a combination. So I think when we use open online spaces, if when we use Twitter and we use, you know, blogging platforms, you know, open spaces, these can become third spaces of learning and, you know, break down this notion of the daily divide. Can I give another example?
Yeah,
in a primary school, you know, one of the things that's happened to me in becoming a connected educator is that I didn't know a lot of primary and secondary teachers until, you know, a few years ago. I knew the people who were in my family and my friends and my children's teachers, and that was it. And when I became active on Twitter, for example, I began to connect with educators not only across the world but across all different sectors. You know, primary school teachers, you know, five-year-olds who had just started using Twitter when I was using Twitter, and we could share. So I've been trying to work with a lot of those teachers and bring them into the university in different ways and us to learn from them. But this one primary teacher, Maura O'Keefe, is doing an awful lot in the past year on having her kids blogging on KidBlog, and yet she has to sit down with the school inspector who comes in, and her eyes are shining when she talks about what her kids have accomplished in their online writing this year in terms of confidence, their plans for themselves for the future, their writing skills. And she has to sit down with a school inspector who says, oh, I don't want to hear anything about that. Show me, you know, show me how they've performed on these, you know, instruments and these assessments. So what Maura is doing is she's taking on the mantle of this daily divide and kind of taking it from her students. So they're getting to have this kind of third space of learning, but she's taking that kind of that burden from them, and she has to sit down with the inspector, and, you know, she's dealing with that, and she talks to her colleagues, and that helps. But I think that's really exciting and such a gift to her students, that she's not making them live that, but, you know, she's taking that burden on for them.
You mentioned there that her eyes were shining, and the word, another word that I wrote down when you were talking in capital letters was joy, that you talked about joy in your thing. And obviously, just listening to you now, we can hear this sort of, you know, sort of good vibrations about an excitement about what you're doing, which overlaps or overflows from your day job. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, how, you know, how do we, maybe that's a way to get people on board, is to not concentrate and saying this will make you a better teacher or this will make you a better learner, but this will make you have a wee bit more joy in your life.
Yes,
I'd quite like you to talk to joy if you could. And it's, there was two joys that were on the pad. There was joy, yes. And then there's joy. Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you. When I ask students what they want from learning and from assessment, you know, one of the things I did earlier this year was I asked a 14-year-old boy to make a film for me. He's a young filmmaker, asking other students how they like to learn. Again, I wanted this idea of it being unmediated by any adult or educator. And the film was fantastic, and the three words that came out for me from listening to the students in that film and in other places are meaning, enjoyment, and connection. I mean, that's what we want as learners. That's what kids are asking for. They don't want, they want things not to be boring. And within the word enjoyment, I highlight the word joy, because it's wonderful if learning can be enjoyable, but occasionally it can be joyful, and that's just wonderful. So that's what informs my practice. That's just simply what informs my practice. If I can help students learn in ways that are meaningful, where they can establish connections and enjoy themselves, and occasionally that it be joyful, then my job is done. Then I'm, you know, then I think we're doing well, and I learn a lot as well, of course.
I was listening to a presentation today delivered by Christina Ranci from University of Salford, and they were describing open feedback processes. Mm-hmm. Which was really interesting. The way that they opened up the feedback and the comments that were given on all of the assignments and projects that their students were doing. I think it was a course for teachers, really. And
yes.
Each of the teachers had blogs, and it was a way where they were sharing each other's work and the comments and the feedback that was given, and it was bringing in a kind of dialogue between the teachers and the students, and that kind of open process was a really interesting idea.
Yes, I was so disappointed not to tune into Chrissy's presentation today, and I looked at her slides on SlideShare, and I will catch up with the recording. But you know, I met Chrissy, I think 2 years ago when I was at the University of Salford, and she's wonderful. She brings a lot of joy to her work. I think that's another. She's a great example of that. The session I remember that I was in with Chrissy in Salford at the Education for a Changing Environment conference. At the end of it, she had a ball of wool and she drew it around, and we all created kind of a physical web that connected us. She was talking about networking. So yes, I think the ideas that Chrissy had in her presentation today were super, and that. Because peer feedback, of course, is one of the most powerful things that happens, you know, in open online spaces.
And there was another process that I quite liked. It was being described to me. It was actually last year. It was at the University of West of Scotland, and it was the use of I think PeerMark, the kind of Turnitin product, which was really interesting. They had groups of students who were submitting assignments, and they were encouraging, peer assessment in this process. So the students submitted their assignments, and they had a week to read some of their peers' assignments papers, and they were given some moments to sort of write the comments against the criteria that they had shared. But the interesting process was that once all of those comments had been given, and once they'd read their other sort of students' work, they were given a further week to then look at their own work again and maybe take on board some of those comments, rewrite the work that they'd done, and then resubmit. And I think that's fantastic, because you have that chance then to see other people's work, and then take those ideas and think for a moment to say, wow, I really wish I'd done that. But then they actually get a chance to rewrite and then submit. And that's kind of breaking a lot of conventions, I think, in the typical kind of AHE marking process. But having that opportunity to take on board the feedback and then apply it to your own work, redo some of those things. The number of times that I've maybe done some work myself and had it graded and then had the feedback afterwards, and you would have thought, oh, if only only I'd had the chance to sort of take that on board and then do it again. And I think giving people that opportunity is fantastic. It's brilliant.
Yes, I agree.
So you turn your summative into assessment for learning.
Super.
We're probably going to have to wrap up in a wee while, so in a minute or two we can give us any final thoughts. Just another note I've got, Catherine, is you mentioned the MOOC word in your presentation.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, I think you did. I've got MOOC written down there anyway.
Oh, and it was then, an aside, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it was. And I've written MOOC and CMOOC and XMOOC. The idea behind the connectives MOOCs, the first ones to arise, was this networked learning. And then it's developed into something else. Do you think we're there's a danger of losing something at this point?
Losing what do you mean specifically?
Losing the connectivity, the possibilities that maybe the CMOOCs
I'm sure I'm just teasing when I say that. I can't remember mentioning it. I mean, some of the best learning experiences I've had myself have been in MOOCs, in CMOOCs. Participated in a few of them even earlier this year, the ET MOOC, and I've learned so much from them and kind of questions. It's enabled me to question my own practice because, I think one of the things I mentioned last Friday was, you know, as educators, whatever level we might be educators, we have to recognize that we're, you know, all of us are deeply scripted in this notion of the educator controls, you know, the learning experience. And I just find that it's, you know, it's a constant process of shedding. Year on year, I keep, you know, I redesign my course and then I learn from the experience and from the students' feedback. And the next year I realize, I can lose this, you know, this would be much better. So, I think the connectivist MOOCs have inspired very, very, very many people to try and bring some of those ideas and practices into education institutions, into formal education, and that's a very good thing. As far as the ex-MOOCs go, it's unfortunate that they've kind of appropriated the term MOOCs because it's a completely different thing in many cases. And, you know, this is all just emerging and we just have to see where it goes. But, you know, I saw Mary Robinson speak last year and she said sometimes she's accused of being an optimist. And she was with Desmond Tutu when he was accused of being an optimist, and she now uses his quote, which is, you know, I'm not an optimist, I'm a prisoner of hope. and I happen to be a prisoner of hope. So, you know, we can gripe about ex-MOOCs and, you know, what they're not and all of that. But, you know, I'm just really trying to apply positive open practices in formal education. I don't think we need to throw out the whole thing. I think we can... It can be a process, you know, of learning and changing. That would be very positive.
Sounds good.
I just want to. I'm plugging. I really do apologize.
Yeah, but it's getting to the plug time of the show. the liquid are just coming up.
There are a couple of presentations coming up tomorrow as part of the online conference. One is tomorrow at 11. And it's actually a PebblePad presentation about portfolios, but it's really interesting because I did have a chance to talk to Shane earlier, and he was showing me how his portfolio, and he keeps telling me not to call it a portfolio, it was an interesting process. Basically, the portfolio system that he has, he was showing a different way to apply to learning and teaching and assessment. And the portfolios the course is developed as a template, I suppose, and he gives out the course structure in a portfolio page, but then he gets his students to take copies of those pages, and embedded within that are a series of activities where you have to think about the work that you're presented with, and you're encouraged to write different ideas of how you would approach different questions. And it's interesting that the material is being delivered and you take a copy of it, embed it within your own portfolio, write about your own experiences, and then share it out with others. And it's just an interesting way to have course material, and it's kind of turning it on its head. And so if you have a chance, it's a really interesting process, one that I'm not describing well, but if you have a chance, tuning in at A11 is a good sort of way to look at that. And the thing about John Hilton and his idea of kind of these branching scenarios and putting into a narrative and allowing students to write their own ideas as they progress through a scenario, Stephen Tucker from the University of Aberdeen, he's using question mark to deliver these kind of decision-driven scenarios. And it's again, just another way of looking at assessment and allowing the students to sort of explore objectives within his assessment processes. He's speaking at 1 o'clock, so if you have a chance, just go along to the eAssessment Scotland website, and I've listed all the links to join all of these sessions freely, so you can just come in and join. You don't need to register. You can just come in and be part of the experience that all of these presenters at the conference, including Catherine. It's just so many stories, so many things to listen to in such a short space of time. But if you have a chance, come along. Have a listen.
One of my sort of main takeaways from the assessment conference was that I took a holiday to come along, but most teachers can't do that. And there's all this real value in coming along to see people and to listen to ideas and have the time to kick back and eat a pastry and have a coffee and talk to somebody about something. But also, you've built up a fantastic set of resources with the people that have been speaking online, Kenji. And is there somewhere that these are going to be available? Have you archived the Adobe Connect conferences and the likes?
Yeah, the really annoying thing is I have about like now 5 years' worth of presentations and videos and stuff. And so I will be spending some time to stick that online and share all the work that everyone's been doing. I mean, one of the great things about the conference is that, I've been attending conferences for years as probably an educator and part of different organizations. And one of the things is the barriers. Sometimes it's to do with cost. Sometimes it's to do with time. And I'm really intrigued, and I really appreciate all the time that Catherine, yourself, all our presenters volunteer their time to come in and share their work openly. I know the work that David Walker does with the University of Dundee, and as partners for the conference, the fact that they kind of open their doors and allow us to use their space and share their time freely to make this all possible is just fantastic. And I really do appreciate it. I spend all my time just saying thank you to people all the time, really, because it's fantastic. I really do appreciate it. I know that none of us who sort of spend our time to set up the conference, we don't draw a salary. We just do it because we appreciate all the good work that's being done, and we just any chance to kind of share that is fantastic.
Well, it always astonishes me that the fact that people who know an awful lot are willing to have a chat with us online. And as I say, usually we figure we'll get half an hour, and it goes on, and they're fascinating. And yourself and Catherine have been really generous with your time, with your knowledge. Can I say thanks very much? If there's anything else, I think we'll. If there's nothing else, I think we'll kind of wrap it up now.
Well, I just want to say thank you, and it was an outstanding conference. And the model of having the online sessions and then the day event and then more online sessions, I really liked that. And even though I knew I wasn't able to participate live in some of the ones I wanted to attend, knowing that I can tune in again is terrific. So thank you all who made that possible. It was really terrific.
And Catherine, can I just say, I am so sorry that we experienced a few technical hitches at the start on the first speaker. And you know, I'm cringing all the time. But I mean, all the people that came up to me afterwards, obviously I never got to see it. But what they all said to me was they loved your session. And they were all so impressed that you weren't fazed by the fact that we were getting a few issues with the speakers and the technology and the fuzz and the crackle.
Well, I knew the issue. Oh, well, that's really nice to hear. That's really, really nice to hear.
I mean,
my take on it is, if you're standing in front of a room full of educators, and I have to figure that every single one of them has been through that situation, you know, at least once. So if you can't stand in front of a room of educators and kind of get past that, then maybe you're in the wrong job. So I knew it was a problem in the room setup. I knew that. So thank you for getting it sorted.
Okay. So I think on that note, folks, we'll say goodnight. We've got more shows next week and every Wednesday for the next week. Well, you can see them at edutalk.cc on the upcoming page, and you'll be able to hear this audio on the edutalk.cc/ just on the page, on the front page actually, and on the Radio Edutalk archive as soon as I've got round to editing it and uploading it, which hopefully will be either tonight, tomorrow, or at least before the weekend. So I just say thank you, folks, and good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.